History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 82nd anniversary of that pivotal day in history that has famously been called the Longest Day. There's even a new movie out in theaters called Pressure that introduces the story of D-Day to new audiences. Over the years, we've heard from quite a few people who participated in the opening stages of the invasion of Normandy, whether by land or sea or air, but almost all of them have since passed away. Today, we get to introduce you to one of the few surviving Americans who took part that day, 105-year-old Martin Copenhafer of Garden Valley, California. He would still be living in Malibu if the infamous Palisades fire hadn't burned his home to the ground. There were some priceless possessions he lost in the process, but one thing no one can take, his memories. And I think you're going to find that even at 105, the recall, the detail, and yes, the emotion is as strong as ever for this resilient survivor. We'll work up to what he experienced 82 years ago this weekend at Omaha Beach. But you know how it works here on Hometown Heroes. We always like to start at the beginning. And for Mr. Copenhafer, that goes all the way back to the Windy City.
Chicago, Illinois. I went through eighth grade in Catholic schools, then went 3 years in high school, public high schools, when we moved to California in 1937. Finished up my last year of high school at Los Angeles High School. Then I enrolled in Los Angeles City College and went there 2 years and then transferred to UCLA. Well, along came World War II. So midway through the last semester at UCLA, I joined the Navy. And that was 5 months after Pearl Harbor. Then served 3.5 years in the Navy. Amphibious forces. The Navy built a whole new branch, the amphibious forces, which were landing ships largely to transfer people on, to put people on the beaches. So that's what we did. And I was on two different LSTs. The first one got bombed and sunk when we invaded Sicily, July 10th, 1943. The second one, why we landed the troops at Normandy on D-Day, and then made some runs, and later I landed the troops down on the Riviera in France in August, and then we went out to the Pacific where we were going to land the people on Japan. Well, the war ended before they had to do that, but that was going to be one big mess, invading Japan, but we were planning on doing it. That was my career there. In December, the day after Christmas in 1945, I got discharged. And I went back to spend another year at UCLA to get a degree, then went to work for the County of Los Angeles in the assessor's office as an appraiser. And that's where I spent the next 35 years. It was a good job. It was an interesting job. You met a lot of interesting people. And so I had the west side of Los Angeles. I had Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Brentwood, Pacific Palisades, and Malibu were all in my region where I worked. And so I got to see a lot of fine homes and meet a lot of interesting people. Finally retired too soon, should have stayed a couple more years, but everybody was retiring. All the friends, we all were all war veterans working down there, and they all left about the same time. So I left too. Sorry I did. I should have stayed a couple more years. Been retired since 1979. Finally wound up living in a nice house out in Malibu, California. We moved out there in 1969. Lived there until the house burned down last year in January in the Palisade fire. best location in California, absolutely the best location. Best climate, you can walk to the beach, absolutely great place to live, except for the Pacific Coast Highway, which is a mess during commute hours, very unpleasant. But aside from that, why, it's the greatest place in the world.
Well, and I'm thinking 105 years, you lived through your ship being sunk in World War II. You're one of the last guys alive who was there landing troops on D-Day. And then the Palisades fire just recently, you lose your home. You've been through all these things. But you told me you almost didn't make it out of your childhood. You said you caught almost every childhood disease there was in the 20s?
Yeah, I caught all of them. Yeah. Yeah, I had them all, one after the other. Every other kid did, too, back in that era. Kids caught all of them, measles, whooping cough, diphtheria, scarlet fever. You got them all. Kids would bring them in the classroom and pass it around. Every kid in the classroom would catch these childhood diseases and didn't kill very many of them, very few of them. We all survived them most generally. And I guess there was herd immunity pretty much as it was all developed down there. Nowadays, I doubt that the kids have the herd immunity that we had then. Got through all of them, as I recollect, and it didn't seem to hurt me any. I got this crooked eye as a result of having pneumonia when I was 1 year old, and survived that pneumonia, but it left me with a crooked eye, and we never managed to straighten it out. Probably if I'd stayed in Chicago, I probably might have gotten it straightened out, but it didn't. We moved to California in 1937, so been in California a long, long time. Never occurred to me to go down and have it operated on and straightened out. I always see out of one eye, generally. I can turn this one on and off. It's always turned off, generally. So too bad I didn't, but never had any money. It would have taken a lot of money to have an operation on that eye to straighten it out. I had a friend that... high school friend that had his eye straightened out. He had a crooked eye too, and he went down after the war and got him operated on and straightened out so he could see binocularly. I don't see binocularly. I don't have the depth perception other people have. Yeah.
Well, it doesn't seem to have held you back all that much. What do you remember about Chicago in those early years? I've heard a few stories, and those are the heyday of Al Capone, right?
Well, Chicago has a nasty climate overall. It's really never nice. It's either cold, windy, and wet, or it's hot and steamy, one or the other. It's terrible climate back there. But when you're a kid, you don't notice all that. I was there during the years when they had the World's Fair. They had a great World's Fair back there for 2 years, 1933 and 1934. I used to ride a bicycle around. We rode bicycles in the traffic. You rode right in the traffic, and people never ran over you. They keep from running over you. And I rode a bicycle around Chicago when I was a kid. And I was not athletic, so I never got into any kind of sports particularly. I was kind of a reader, though. I read a lot. I spent a lot of time reading. My son spent a lot of my summers down in Ohio with my grandparents. And so I spent more time down there in Ohio, in Springfield, Ohio, in 2 months every year down there. It was, you know, pretty easygoing summer. My father was doing all right. We lived there during the Depression when things were really tough for about 6 or 7 years after the stock market crash. Things were dead, dead, dead. There was nothing going on. No new construction. People that were in the building trades were all on welfare. Welfare in those days was $15 a week. That's all you got paid. You had to live on $15 a week. Well, my dad always had a good job, and we were able to afford to have an automobile and travel around. We even had a little summer home down there on Lake Michigan that we'd go out to in the summertime. We had a pretty good time of it. Didn't own a house. My father bought a house back in the early 20s. Found out you had to shovel coal in the basement to keep the furnace going. Well, my dad was not the kind of man that shoveled coal. So the house went on the market the next summer, spring, and they got rid of it. And And we lived in apartments from then on. Yeah, my dad was a very smart man, very capable person, a lot smarter than I am, that was for sure. And a man with a lot of courage. In 1937, my aunt from Seattle came back to Chicago to buy a new car. In those days, there was enough freight on automobiles that you could afford it. Freight you saved would pay for a trip. So my mother and I rode back to Seattle with her. But on the way, we stopped in Southern California for her to visit her stepson. So we got the grand tour from the stepson's wife. And man, it was gorgeous. You can't believe how nice Southern California was in 1937. Truck gardens, not much traffic. And she gave us the whole tour. We went to Hollywood and we went to Long Beach and they had a big market down, drove down by the pier where they had the tuna factories down there in the harbor. It was just great. And the weather was absolutely ideal. So we spent 6 weeks in Seattle, but that did not impress me any and my mother. So we got back to Chicago. All we could do was talk about Los Angeles. My father says, well, if it's that great, let's go. So he quit his job, and we sold the furniture, and we moved to Southern California, just like that. He never doubted his ability to make a living, and we did. He always made a living. A man really, really very great courage and very competent and capable, just a hell of a lot smarter than any of the rest of us. Yeah.
And you had a couple brothers?
Yes, two brothers, older brother and younger brother. Yeah, my older brother went in the Army. He was one of the first guys drafted after Pearl Harbor. No, before Pearl Harbor. He was drafted a year before Pearl Harbor. He was fortunate because his unit was shipped over to the Philippine Islands before the war. And that unit was all the people that were on the death march in Bataan. Yeah. And fortunately, he missed that because he had pneumonia. About the time his unit was shipped out, he had pneumonia, and he was in the hospital. So he left his unit and went to another one. Although he was over there on D-Day plus 10, and he fought his way all up to the end of the war, up through Europe and all that. He had a very tough, interesting career in the Army. He was in artillery, 6-inch guns. He was in corps artillery. When the war ended, with a name like Copenhagen, they assumed he knew German. Well, he didn't, but he knew a few words of it. So he interrogated prisoners that were looking for the SS people. And so he'd interrogate the people there for a couple months before he got discharged. He wouldn't go back to Germany. Back in 1983, I cooked up the idea, why don't we go over and visit Germany? We said, no, I've seen all that country, I want to. He said no. So, but it went anyway. It went with my three cousins.
Thinking I've got a daughter who's a sophomore at UCLA right now, but I'm guessing that life at UCLA in 2026 is a little different than 1941.
When I went to UCLA, there was 8,000 students. That's all. You drove your car right onto the campus and parked right in the middle of the campus. Yeah, and it was free. There was no tuition. Quite different now. There's 44,000 students at UCLA, and absolutely jammed and packed, and no place to park except in the parking buildings. Yeah, it's a totally different affair right now than what it was when I went there. Maybe better curriculum, maybe better taught, I don't know. It was pretty relaxed when I was there, I remember. Yeah, I went before the war and then after the war. It took me 5 years, by the all told, because I was in my last semester at UCLA when I joined the Navy. And so, after 3.5 years, I didn't remember. I was an accounting major. Well, I didn't know any accounting after 3.5 years. So I went back and changed my major to management. Spent another year taking management classes, which worked out pretty well. As it turned out, management was the right thing, really. It worked out well where I worked on the assessor's office in L.A. County.
And I know you said athletics wasn't your thing, but I'm thinking this was a time where UCLA had Kenny Washington and Jackie Robinson. Yes. And Woody Strode.
We were contemporaries, Jackie Robinson and Washington. We were contemporary. I know Jackie Robinson was a great athlete. He was a football player, a baseball player, a basketball player, and he was good at all of them. Yeah, and Washington, Kenny Washington was their backbone of their football team. I remember the time there. At the time I was there also, I later worked with the guy who was on the football team back when Washington was on the, and Robinson was on the football team. He was on the football team too. Big guy. Yeah, big tough guy, yeah. But I was not into athletics. I took golf. Golf. Never learned anything about it. Guy never told us that you had to develop a swing to play golf. And, you know, you just stood up there and whack golf balls. A couple times a week, we'd go out to the driving range they had there and just hit a bucket of balls, and that was our golf that we had. You had to turn in a receipt showing that you'd played a round of golf somewhere. So that was cheap. In those days, go out to Griffith Park in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock, the price to play a round of golf dropped to 50 cents. So you'd play a round of golf for 50 cents. Sometimes you get 14, 15 holes in before it got too dark. 50 cents. That was my golf career. My sport was archery, shooting the bow. I shot the bow there for 50 years. Competed in Senior Olympics. Probably still hold a record in the Senior Olympics. Probably when I was 89 years old, I shot a real good round at the Senior Olympics. And it could well be that's still the top round that was shot for a guy 89 years old.
And now he's 105. And come January, we'll hit 106. But we're going to take him back to his World War II days when we come back. He is one of our last living links to D-Day, but also a reminder that for the men participating in that invasion 82 years ago, many had already experienced their baptisms by fire, which in Mr. Copenhafer's case came nearly a year earlier. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 105-year-old Martin Copenhafer of Garden Valley, California. Originally from Chicago, he spent most of his life in Southern California, where his job included assessing the property of countless Hollywood stars. But 82 years ago this weekend, he was on an LST landing troops at Normandy. We'll get to his memories of the longest day eventually, but what about the first day of the war for America, December 7th, 1941? You remember where you were and how you found out Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
I was a student at that time at UCLA, December 41. I really have very little about it, know about it, except that the newspapers were full of it. And everybody in Los Angeles was panicked. They expected the Japanese fleet to show up off them and bombard Los Angeles. They were all scared to death. Can't believe how frightened the people were. And so immediately everybody had to put up blackout curtains. And they set up gun batteries on the Baldwin Hills and all around. And they were going to, because they expected Japanese to be flying over the city, bombing the city at any minute. You can't imagine the panic they had. I remember one night we had the air raid in Los Angeles. They thought it was an air raid. It wasn't an air raid at all. Weather balloon blew across the city. And they were shooting guns off an aircraft all over, shooting at this balloon or anything else they thought they saw up there. It was ridiculous. I know I sat on the back steps of our house watching all the shooting going on at the time. But I was working at that time. I didn't have any money, so when I went to UCLA, I had to pay my way, my living expenses pretty much. I had a job at the Bank of America. Used to go to work down there at 5 o'clock at night, sorting checks in the clearinghouse. And then we'd work until we sorted all the checks. Then I'd come home and catch a few hours sleep, then go out to the university, go to school then for a few hours, and then go back to work in the evening on the treadmill is what I was on doing that. And so I didn't get much out of UCLA. Couldn't engage in any of the social activities there pretty much when I was out there because I had a full-time job pretty much. Yeah, we worked 6 days a week.
Had you had any friends or acquaintances who were Japanese-American?
Oh, yeah, sure. I have several of them. I had a Japanese lady working in my office. She'd been interned up there by Tule Lake during the war. Another guy I worked with, he was interned up at Manzanar. He was a kid, he said, 16 years old. He said he used to go out and pee in the creek, went down into the river, the Owens River, start drinking water, he said, every morning. Yeah, Victor. Yeah, he was a good guy. I went fishing with him several times. He was a veteran. He had been, after the war, he went and served in the 442nd Japanese Battalion, and he was a war veteran, but he had organized fishing trips. We lost a whole bunch of all that fishing tackle when the house burned down. It burned up the fishing rods, the reels, and everything. Probably $1,000 worth of fishing tackle got burned up. Anyway, that much, maybe more than that, because I had a couple big boxes full of fishing tackle that all burned up too. We burned up all our stuff in that fire. We burned up all our personal effects got burned up, everything. We got out of the house with the clothes on our backs. We waited too long. We just could not believe the house would burn down. Oh, the fire was over in the next canyon, was blowing away from us. So we figured we were okay. We sat there watching it on television. Instead of loading the car with all the important stuff, we waited until... Finally, when the embers began to blow by the house, we said, hey, it's time to get out of here. I can't walk, you know. So Ron and I went around and gathered up the important papers, the insurance policy, and some of the box with the birth certificates and stuff like that, and loaded that. But all my genealogy stuff, I'd spent 30 years doing genealogy, about 20 years. All that got burned up, all of it. And I had two big containers, file boxes full of genealogy material, all of which is gone. I spent lots of time on hundreds and hundreds of hours on worked on family tree research. A lot of it in Pennsylvania, and we did some in Germany, a little bit of it what we could. Most of it in Ohio, where my family came from. Was a mother and father came from Ohio, and their mother and fathers came from, might have German ancestors, couldn't do much with them. My German grandfather, for one thing, I couldn't talk to him. He didn't speak English very well. And I never thought of in those days talking family tree with him. Anyway, back when they were alive, when I should have been out talking and get family tree, I wasn't into it yet. I didn't get into it. They're wrong. If you're going to ever get in family tree, get in it now when there's still some people alive to talk to.
Yeah, great advice. What about joining the Navy? What motivated you to do that when you did it?
Well, my brother, I mentioned earlier, was in the Army, drafted in the Army. He was in the first call. And so he came home on leave, and he told me, hey, look, you got a low draft number. You're going to be drafted in a few months. He says, let me give you advice. Stay out of the Army. He says, join the Air Force, join the Navy, but stay out of the Army. So I took him at his word. So when I was getting close to getting called up, first I went down to try to get a commission. I had almost 4 years of college in, but my crooked eye kept me out of getting a commission. So I went down the middle of May after Pearl Harbor and joined the Navy, which I was fortunate. I hit it right at the right time because the Navy was building their amphibious forces. They were building up service schools because they needed people with ratings to know how to do things. So I spent 4 weeks in San Diego and then had a good GCT score. So I was able to get into the quartermaster school, which is a great rating because that's the ship's control. You're up on the bridge and you know what's going on. And you handle the signaling and flag hoists and the charts and things like that. You do all that kind of stuff. Your station is usually on general quarters, is in the wheelhouse. That's where mine always was, seeing that things are going right in the wheelhouse, that the guy in the helm is doing what he's been told, being told to do. It was a good job. And so then I spent my time, and eventually I wound up as the chief quartermaster. It's a good rating. Spent all my time pretty much with a fellow who I met very early in my very first LST. He was a bosun mate, and he and I, both of us advanced at the same time. He got appointed chief bosun mate the same time I got appointed chief quartermaster. And we were real good friends, stayed good friends after the war. Didn't stay in touch with him until we began to do our reunions. When captain of the ship, the second ship I was on, he started to arrange reunion groups. Everybody had World War II reunions. We did 22 reunions. The last one about 2002, I guess. So thereabouts, 2002, 2003, I think it was the last one we had. By that time, everybody pretty well aged out, you know. And so that was about the end of the reunions. But I stayed in touch with that whole group of people. I'm the only one left, of course. And the same way with all the people I work with. We're all World War II veterans, all the same age. They're all gone, every one of them. All my bunch that I shot archery with, they're all gone, every one of them. There's nobody left of me. That's what happens when you get to be 105. Why, there's nobody left that you knew. They're all gone, all of them. And the men mostly have a fall.
So this first LST, yeah. They sent you all the way to Sicily?
Yes. We put to sea with that LST. We put it in commission in New York and sailed it down in New York, practiced out in the middle of New York Harbor out there, when the steering gear, of course, went. The LSTs had terrible steering gear. They had electromagnetic or something like that steering gear. Electric hydraulic is how it was, and it broke down all the time. And so my station at that time was in the steering engine room. So anyway, I'm down there in the steering engine room, and we're out, the ship's out there maneuvering out in the deal with no steering. So I get a call from the bridge. It says, rig up the manual steering. They said the steering gears broke down. Hell, nobody ever told me how to rig up the manual steering down there. So I'm sitting there looking at the steering, figured, just how do I tackle this, you know, to rig this stuff up? And the door opens, and in pops in the electrician office. Electrician, he is an older man, Pop Crane, they called him Pop, and he knew his stuff. He fixed it. He fixed the steering right there. In a minute, he had it going again, so he bailed me out. I never did learn how to hook up the manual steering. Later, my station was moved up to the bridge, and I didn't have to go back down in that steering engine room. That was a terrible place. Yeah, the 3-inch gun was mounted on the deck right above it. And you go down there and they shoot that gosh darn gun. And it sounded like you're in the middle of a big drum when the gun went off. Yeah, that LST, well, we had two men on board that had ever been to sea before, two. One of them was a guy who had been on a destroyer That's the guy that became the bosun mate, him and a Florida fisherman. We were the only two, they were the only two. And so we start out across the ocean with nobody having ever been at sea, including the captain of the ship. So the convoy commodores said, okay, everybody run up a flag hoist, say where we are, what your position is. Hell, we didn't have a clue. So anyway, we had an executive officer who was a little older than the rest of us, who was the smartest man, smart guy, really bright. He'd been a school teacher, and he later on became captain of the 286, and a good man. So he says, okay, guys, we're going to learn how to navigate, see what we got in the way of materials. We got the, so we had HO-214, hydrographic office 214. We had a nautical almanac. We had a couple of sextants. We had all the things you needed to navigate. We had a chronometer, two chronometer watches, actually. Navy wouldn't trust an LST with a real chronometer. You had a chronometer watch and a couple of stopwatches. So we sat down there, and he conducted classes for a couple of days. So we learned all the officers, none of them, all been to 90-day wonder school. They didn't know anything about it either. So they included the quartermasters, me and the other quartermaster. They included us in the classes. So we both, all of us, learned how to navigate. So by the time we got another couple, a couple of days later, we were able to find our position very nicely.
It's time for our final break, and I'm starting to realize that in order to fit in Mr. Copenhafer's complete story, we're going to have to continue this conversation over another episode of Hometown Heroes. But long before he risked his life on D-Day, he almost lost his life 11 months earlier, July 10th, 1943. We'll hear about it as only this 105-year-old can tell us when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with the amazing Martin Copenhafer, one of America's last D-Day survivors who is now 105 years old. But we're going to go back now to when he was just 22. A year before he would land troops from the 1st Infantry Division on Omaha Beach, he was a quartermaster on an LST, and he was soon to find out just how deadly his duties could be.
So we learned to sail the LST over to the Mediterranean, spent a couple of months over there, off the Algerian coast and Oran, Algiers, and a couple other small places. Liberty, I'll tell you, Liberty was interesting. I was just being a kid. I didn't know what was going on. But I'll tell you, it ain't like that now. I mean, people look different. The men all wore these funny pants, the pants they had. They tied at the knee, big and baggy, and pulled up around their waist. That's the kind of pants the men wore. The women were all wearing burkas, you know, all cover up. And occasionally you see someone without a nose. No nose. They cut off her nose because for infidelity. And we saw several of them. And then you go into town, and there would be a guy out in the middle of the square doing some performance, sword swallowing. You ever seen a guy sword swallow?
Only on TV, yeah.
Yeah, well, we'd see these guys out there sword swallowing, you know, for what you could give them. It was terribly interesting. It was, people were nice. They're nice. They're always after you for something. They're looking for whatever you might have, a trade. It was, we got into Algiers, and of course they have the Kasbah, And they just had that movie about the Kasbah with some movie actor, famous movie actor. So, of course, it was off limits. That'd make a difference. Everybody went there anyhow, the Kasbah. Little snaky, windy streets. And I remember I bought a bracelet for my mother. Had a big green stone on it. And the guy said, oh, that's an emerald. You know, the thing was as big as your thumbnail. And I knew it wasn't an emerald for crying out. You don't, for $25, you don't get an emerald the size of your thumbnail. I knew it was a piece of beer bottle is what it was that somebody ground down and turned into a polished stone. But it was a nice-looking bracelet. And I guess he got $25 for it. I lost that when the ship got bombed and sunk. It was, I was going to bring it home. Yeah, I lost that. Everything else I had on board the ship, only thing I had was the blue jeans I was wearing and shirt and saved my shoes. I was afraid I'd get sandburrs on my feet when the ship sunk. I went over the side and was swimming for the beach when I got picked up.
Yeah, tell me about that day. You said July 10th, 1943?
Yeah, July 10th, 1943. Yeah. Yes, it was an interesting day. We got there at daylight before it got light, and we were sitting out there waiting to go to unload our people on the beach. We had an anti-aircraft battery aboard. The whole ship was full of anti-aircraft guns and trucks and ammunition. The whole thing was loaded up, and we had this company of guys on there. There was probably maybe 80, 100 soldiers on board, maybe at least that many. So we sat out there, all of us, watching the battle going on. We couldn't see much on the beach except the shelling. They were shelling the beach from the cruiser and a monitor. British had a monitor out there, had a ship with one turret and two guns. And they were out farther than the cruisers. You could tell the difference in the shells. So they were shooting big stuff. The monitor was shooting low-evidence stuff, and it was red. And you'd see them fire, and you'd see those two big shells sailing overhead towards the beach. Then you see the cruiser, and they had smaller guns, and they were white. And we watched them knock out the German tanks. There were three tanks coming down the road towards the beach, and that cruiser, he was a good mile off the beach, and he knocked them out, every one of them, bam, bam, bam. Those guys, the gunners, they were pretty good. They took out those tanks. Then we watched the air battles. The Germans, there were Messerschmitts and a few British aircraft were there. British aircraft, we didn't have any real air cover. We just had a few guys come up from Malta and spend as much time there as they could. But they couldn't spend much time there. They had to get back, save enough gas to get back to Malta. And they were fighting. We watched one of the British, what the heck's the British aircraft? They had one of them get shot down, and the guy parachuted out, and they went out and picked him up. Somebody in a small boat picked him up. And we watched the Messerschmitt shoot down a little Piper Cub that was the spotter for the cruiser. They shot him down. He ducked around as much as he could, but eventually the Messerschmitt got him. And that sort of stuff you watch. You're watching the sort of thing you see on TV. You know, we were sitting there watching this battle going on all the time. And we didn't get orders to go to the beach till 6 o'clock. So we finally got orders to go and unload. So we take it in and on the beach, and there's several other LSTs on the beach there then. So we ran alongside one of them, got stuck on the sandbar. We had too much load, I guess, and so we got stuck. And so we had to run the engines and hold the helm hard over to keep it headed in there. And we were getting ready to rig up a pontoon to hook up to the front of the LST so that the vehicles could roll into the beach when the guy got us with a bomb. He came down the beach a couple times dropping a bomb, and he dropped one of them right in between the one ship next to us and one beyond it there. And then the third run, he got us and dropped a bomb, and it hit the ship, and it went right on in, right on through, right up at the forward part of the ship. First, you know, I'm in the back end of the ship, the stern, and heard this big boom. And I wasn't sure we'd been hit or not. It was a close miss. But somebody says, yeah, he hit us. We got a bomb hit. So the captain says, okay, all hands fight fire, he says. So I'm in the wheelhouse. So I'm, at that time, I'm holding onto the helm, holding hard over. So I got a chair, a stool, and propped the helm and started forward to go up to help fight fire. I hadn't taken 10 steps when the captain says, abandon ship. Well, I didn't go back to the wheelhouse. I probably should have gone back to the wheelhouse and ordered the engines turned off. Nobody ordered the engine room to turn off the engines. The bosun mate came by. He told me later on, and he went in the wheelhouse, and he ordered the engines shut off. The guys down in the engine room didn't know what was going on. They finally turned the engines off, and so that's when I went over the side and climbed down the. We had these rope of Dale's, say, you hang on the, over there, a landing net, you know, and you go down, climb down to the water and jumped out over a bunch of guys that were hanging on to the side of the, couldn't swim, and they were hanging on to the side of that net. And I figured this ship's going to blow up. Earlier in the day, we watched a ship blow up. It was sitting out there. It was a big black freighter loaded with ammunition. And it was fire smoking. It was on fire. Then the next thing, kaboom, no ship. Just like that. Yeah, watch that happen. I hope the guys are off of it. But anyway, I was swimming for the beach. I kept my shoes. I strung them around my neck. And I didn't do it right at all. I should have taken off my blue jeans. Hard to swim in blue jeans. Should have taken them off. But I didn't. And so I was struggling. And a guy came by in a small boat. One of the guys from our ship reached down there. He was aboard, and he pulled me up on board the thing. And there was a guy laying up in the front of the small boat. And it was an LCVP, I guess. No, it was bigger than that. It was an LCM. And he was up to saying the Lord's Prayer, repeating it over and over and over. I don't think he was wounded. He might have been. I don't know, but he was scared to death anyway. He figured his time had come. So eventually we loaded up the ship with people. We picked up, fished out the water. Then we went over by the LST and picked up those guys hanging on the rope alongside it, hanging on the landing net, picked all them up. They were most all GIs picked up. The GIs took a terrible licking. We only lost one sailor, but we lost 40, 50 GIs. In those days, they thought that LSTs were going to run and dash up on the beach and drop the ramp, and all the quick trucks were going to roll right out on the beach. And so they had your tank deck, you had big fans to clear out the air. And they had all the guys down there sitting in their trucks with the engines running. And so in order to pull all that exhaust fumes out, they had these fans. And so those guys had been sitting down there for 15 or 20 minutes when the bomb hit. Well, they didn't have a chance. The explosion killed most of those guys. And the ones that didn't kill, were all burned in terrible shape. So some of our crew went down and helped these guys as best they could to get up on the deck up there to unload them. And eventually we got the people off the LST back onto a pontoon, from the pontoon onto another LST, and saved them out. We got them off that way. But for that medal, both the captains of the two LSTs both got Navy crosses, which they were entitled to. They handled it very, very well. The next day, while the captain came by trying to round up his crew, some of them were on the beach, some of them were on one ship, some were on another, and so I spent the night on board a big transport. And the next day, I came down and went back, and we all went over on this other LST, 311. We spent the rest of the day and the next day on the beach over there. And then eventually, I manned a gun there one night, helped relieve the crew. Our crew relieved the crew that was on there to give so the guys could get some sleep. And we went back to North Africa, stayed right outside Tunis. And while I was over there at this place, I hitchhiked into Tunis to see what Tunis looked like. It was all shot up like usual, like everywhere I ever went. They were all shot up all the time. They fought the battle through Tunis. After they shoot a battle through the place, there ain't much of a left. And so anyway, why we waited for a ride back to the States. So General Bradley wanted to go back to the States. We put us on a ship with General Bradley, and we went back to Norfolk, Virginia. And I got a 30-day leave, took the train back to California, spent most of a month in California, went back to, reported back to Pittsburgh, where we're going to pick up another LST. He gave me 2 more weeks' leave because the ship wasn't ready yet. So I went down to Ohio and spent the time with my aunt and uncle. Eventually, while we picked up the 286 and sailed it down the Mississippi River, Ohio and Mississippi, and commissioned it in New Orleans, and then trained in the Gulf of Mexico for a month or so, and sailed up to New York, eventually went over to in the North Atlantic, February and early March, and landed over in England at Milford Haven. We were very fortunate. The weather was very, very mild. The seas were not that rough. There were monster swells. We had to be 50 feet tall, but they were not blowing and were not rough. We'd ride up over these swells. We had 300 hams on board. The commissary steward figured cold weather he'd be able to keep these hams. They all spoiled, 300 hams, and had to heave them over the side. We landed in Milford Haven, and then we went down and spent our time between middle of March and June 6th shuttling around between the ports on the south coast of England and got as far up as Cardiff, Wales. Yeah, shuffled around there back and forth, up Bournemouth, Dartmouth, Plymouth, all these little towns down there along the south coast. We visited them, and they're all blown up. All of them were shot up. The German V1s, they were drones, but they had no control once they launched, and they just, wherever they hit, that's what they hit. And all those little towns on the south coast were all blown up. Plymouth was all blown up. Everything was blown up in Plymouth.
Before we get into what happened over there in the Channel and the invasion of Normandy, you told me the story of July 10th, 1943. You told me about the guy who was up there reciting the Lord's Prayer, and you said he was scared. How about you? Were you ever scared? Did you ever think your life was going to end?
No, I didn't. The only time I was ever really scared was during Operation Tiger.
Not to leave you with a cliffhanger, but that's where we're going to have to stop for today. Perhaps you've heard about Operation Tiger, an ill-fated practice invasion at Slapton Sands. We're going to hear about that, as well as his D-Day landing, from one of our last links to that longest day, next time on Hometown Heroes, Martin Copenhafer. What an amazing 105-year-old. Don't miss the rest of his story on our next episode, when we will be reminded again of something Mr. Copenhafer understands at a depth many of us never could. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.